From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2013 when Judge Amy Coney Barrett was asked about Roe v. Wade. She said that it was unlikely Roe would ever be overturned and that abortion would remain legal. The question was whether it would be publicly funded. But things have changed dramatically. As NPR reports, President Trump has made no secret of his intentions regarding the U.S. Supreme Court and abortion rights. During a debate 4 years ago, Trump vowed to appoint justices who would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade, a decision made in 1973 that legalized abortion nationwide. Trump said, quote, "That will happen automatically, in my opinion, because I am putting pro-life justices on the court. I will say this, it will go back to the states, and the states will then make a determination," end quote. When Amy Coney Barrett had confirmation hearings before the U.S. Senate, she said that Roe is settled law and has survived many challenges in court. She suggested that she doesn't believe it will be overturned. But now, with Coney Barrett on track to become the next Supreme Court justice, she might have the power to do what she predicted would not be done. And it's clear that her supporters will be cheering her on, expecting her to end federal protection for abortion and send the issue back to states, as the president has said. So what happens if that comes to pass? What can we expect in states like New York? How many states could see abortion outlawed entirely? Our guests this hour will discuss this issue from a number of angles, and I will welcome them now. Sharon Stiller is partner and director of the employment law practice at Abrams, Fensterman, Fensterman, Eisman, Fermato, Ferrero, Wolf, and Carone.
You're getting so good at that, Evan.
I can do it in my sleep. Also a board member for the National Women's Hall of Fame. Nice to have you, Sharon. Thanks for being back with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Clark is a longtime legislative staff member for multiple members of the United States Senate and a candidate now for New York State Assembly in the 136th District. Sarah, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Reverend Rick Ledoux is the lead pastor of the United Methodist Church of Webster. Reverend Ledoux, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Evan. It's good to be with you again.
Well, let's get all of your takes just on sort of what the landscape looks like now. Sarah Clark, I've said on this program recently, I remember when Rob Astorino was the Republican candidate for governor against Andrew Cuomo. Astorino was asked about whether New York State ought to codify abortion rights, and he said, why? Roe is never going to be overturned. It's the law of the land. Let's move on. I wonder now if you view the work of state elected leaders as more urgent or at least more relevant in many states, not just New York State?
Absolutely. You know, passing and codifying the Reproductive Health Act, which codified Roe v. Wade into state law, the protection of it for those in New York, was so critical and important for women here in our state. But what you have seen over the last 3 or 4 years, as we have put more conservative judges on all benches across the country, not just the Supreme Court, that states have gotten really, really loose and really emboldened to tighten down their laws when it comes to choice and reproductive health access for the women in their state. So we've already seen that it happened just in the last 3 years as more and more justices across the federal bench are becoming more conservative. Some states to the point where they're even outlawing abortion after 6 weeks, which most women don't even know they're pregnant at that point. So really, we have seen big restrictions going into place right now. And it's really troubling for me, which is why I think leadership of the state is going to be so critical.
Reverend Ledoux, we've seen conservatives call for years for the overturning of Roe and the desire to see judges give that a chance to happen. Do you see that as more in reach now?
I think many conservative folks see this as a possibility and have been excited with the nomination, have been encouraged by the possibility ahead. Since it would be referred back to the states, it would then become a state issue. So I'm not so sure some pro-life folks in New York State are as excited as some folks nationally, because as was mentioned, the law in 2019 made things different here in New York.
But do you get the sense, though, that there is energy on that side that says this is finally going to happen? This is not just something that we can kind of take off the table.
Sure, I think there is some optimism. Yeah.
Okay. Sharon Stiller, when it comes to the legal side of things, as Sarah Clark said, states will potentially have a lot of discretion, and that's what the president wants. 50 states, potentially 50 different frameworks. What are some of your first thoughts about what that means in a post-Roe world, Sharon?
Well, I'm not sure there's going to be a post-Roe world. So maybe we can start there, because Roe was, in essence, a compromise on when women have a right to privacy in their own bodies and when states have a right to protect fetuses. So there have been a lot of challenges, including a challenge that was decided in the United States Supreme Court in June, which upheld the right to privacy. So I think it's going to depend on what the parameters are. There certainly have been a number of challenges, and there continue to be a number of challenges. And while initially the states were attempting to challenge Roe in increments, small pieces, they've become more emboldened and probably will become more emboldened given the nomination of Judge Barrett. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those small pieces or even an overall affront on Roe v. Wade will be successful. So it's a balance. It's a complete balance. It's an interesting legal balance, I think.
Okay. Listeners, if you want to weigh in on this conversation on the future of Roe v. Wade, and as Sharon Stiller mentioned, I mean, it's not a guarantee that we're headed for a post-Roe United States, but it looks more possible now with a possible conservative supermajority on the U.S. Supreme Court if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed. Conservatives could be very close to a long-held dream, and progressives could be close to what they would perceive as a nightmare. I mean, it could be going that way. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And, Sarah, when you look at polling on this issue, I don't want to be crass and just turn everything into polling, but I do think public sentiment it matters, and if the court were to overturn Roe and send it to the states, if that were seen as sort of as a repudiation of abortion nationwide, that would go against the national public sentiment, which is over 60% in favor of abortion rights. But that's not a fixed number throughout a pregnancy, and there's a sliding scale. And the longer into a pregnancy that a woman goes, the less likely an American would be to say, yes, I think she'd have abortion rights all the way through. So it's complex. Is there a concern that, I don't mean to both sides of this, Sarah, but is there a concern that if the court overturns Roe, that doesn't reflect what the national populace wants, but if there is no restriction on abortion at all, that also perhaps doesn't reflect what the national populace wants by majority or plurality? I mean, how much are you concerned about that?
Well, I think that there's a lot of misconceptions around sort of later into pregnancies, when and how those decisions are made. And sort of, you know, these are really private decisions made between a woman, her family, her physician, sometimes her faith community, whatever it may be. So I think depending on how polling is asked, and I've never participated in one, I mean, I've seen support in general for Roe v. Wade as high as 73% across our country. But again, that sliding scale, as you move through a pregnancy, it would be interesting to see how those questions are phrased. I mean, I don't think anyone takes later in pregnancy abortion lightly. These are often decisions made for the life of the mother. For me, it's just the issue of trying to make something illegal or legal takes the decision-making away from the woman and her doctor and her family and puts it in the hands of the government, which I just don't see that. I don't see that as adding value. We're not empowering women to make the right decisions. We're shaming them. And that just is counterproductive to what I think we all want at the end of the day, which is women to make educated decisions and empowered to make their own decisions about their family.
Reverend Ledoux, how do you see it?
Well, I agree with Sarah that we want to be compassionate towards folks, but I also want to be compassionate towards the baby and make sure the baby has a choice. So, you know, it's why I joined a crisis pregnancy center board of directors, is because they come alongside the folks who find themselves in that situation, and they say, we're not going to we're going to make sure that you're not on your own, that we're going to come alongside, make sure you have a support group, make sure that you are encouraged. They provide clothing and supplies for the woman if she chooses to give birth. And so, you know, so often this issue has been politicized, when we have to get back to the root problem of making sure that women's health concerns are met and that we are being compassionate as a society. And also, you know, the church needs to step up too, and we need to make sure that we're reaching out to these folks and making sure that that people's needs are being met.
All right, and let me just briefly turn back to Sarah for that, because the Reverend's responding to some of your concerns and offering an idea for what maybe compassion can look like in a post-Roe world. Does that work for you, Sarah?
You know, we've already seen it, and to take it back into how women make decisions about their family planning and their pregnancies, I mean, we've already seen in just insurance coverage and regulation of taking away women's ability to get the birth control of their choice and have that covered. So I always think it's a little fuzzy to say we're going to support women when we've already seen that we're not going to cover through insurance the choice that they make in terms of their birth control. And so I do think that it's, you know, once a woman is pregnant, some of those decisions that could have been made before may have already been regulated and decided for her instead of her being able to choose it herself. So I just find that a little, I don't know. I think we can do a lot more to really make sure women have all the choices at their hand and let them make the decision.
Okay. And I already have questions coming in. I'm going to kick them to Sharon Stiller coming up here. And if you're on the phone, hang there. I've got some emails as well. Before I do that, let me just ask Reverend Ledoux to sort of follow that point, because what Sarah is saying, Reverend, is the kind of concern that I've heard expressed often, which is, you know, if someone is in favor of abortion rights, they may be able to understand at least the argument that someone who does not want to see abortion legal, they could understand, even if they don't agree with it. There's less understanding of not allowing for contraception, for example. Is there some dissonance there, Reverend?
I'm not exactly sure what you're asking. Let me respond and see if I'm getting to what you're
okay.
asking. I've always felt like people are just not pro-abortion. Even you just said, you know, pro-abortion rights. But I don't feel like people in general are pro-abortion. And so I think when I said that I wish this wasn't politicized, is I feel like the politicization of the topic ends up simplifying it beyond where it should be. There are issues that I think if we could get away from the politics, we could begin to discuss, like the ones you're talking about, and in terms of the care and the individual situations that arise. So I feel like if we could have those conversations, that would be the better place to go as a country when this issue arises. Instead, we get into our camps and we say it's either yes or no, and we end up forgetting the real people with the real needs and the nuances that are involved.
Well, I mean,
does that kind of say?
With respect, not really, because I think what some might argue is they don't understand why contraception would be political. They don't understand why birth control would be political, or why that becomes a right-left thing or a conservative progressive thing. What is the objection that seems consistent there? Can if you don't want abortion legal, which people who disagree with you can understand, they may not understand how you also don't want them to have birth control. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think that we can have those conversations. If we could say we agree that abortion is not right, then let's have those other conversations on those other matters. So that's kind of what I'm saying, is that then we can get to the more specifics and the more details and have those conversations. I don't know. I don't think I'm answering your question. I don't know how to better say what I'm saying.
Sarah Clark, did I bungle it? Go ahead, Sarah. this could be the host's fault. I mean, it usually is. Go ahead, Sarah Clark. You might be on mute, Sarah. Try it again. Oh, boy. Sarah, are you on mute? I've really bungled this now. This is mostly, it's usually.
Evan, even if Sarah isn't there, I'm going to fill
Sharon
in.
Sharon Stiller, yeah, go ahead.
Because a couple of interesting things. So when you talk about Roe versus Wade, the issue that the court dealt with was not whether abortion is right or wrong or the moral issues. It's the depth of the preservation of rights under the Constitution. But I was interested in your question to the Reverend because the decision to expand the right of privacy to include some abortions in Roe v. Wade was the same analysis that was used to permit or to reverse the ban on contraception. It all stems from the right of privacy and how much control women should be entitled to have under the Constitution over their own body. So to some extent, maybe I've answered the question for Reverend Ledoux, because the constitutional protection stem from the same right of privacy.
Reverend, go ahead.
Well, thank you for the help there, Sharon. I appreciate that.
Hey, my pleasure.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think we've got Sarah Clark back. Do you want to weigh in there? Go ahead, Sarah.
I may have missed a lot of that conversation. My phone line cut out. So I'm not quite sure what was being discussed. But for me, I guess it is always the ultimate choice of, the argument is being choice or anti-choice. And for me, I feel like this really lays the choice should be within the woman and her family and her physician and whatever else may go into that choice, and not allowing the government to say a choice is illegal or legal. So for me, that's really the what it comes down to.
Well, Sharon Stiller, I have a question from a listener already about whether a post-Roe world could see prosecution of mothers and mothers-to-be, of women. We know that before 1973, doctors were occasionally prosecuted for abortion. The question now may be different, and I want to read a little bit from a piece written by Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. She writes the following, quote, "In a post-Roe America, some women would be able to get abortion-inducing medications that weren't available the last time abortion was criminalized. But today's legal context has been transformed by decades of anti-abortion activism, equating abortion with murder, as well as by mass incarceration. While doctors were prosecuted for abortions before Roe, patients rarely were. Today, in states that have legislated fetal personhood, women are already arrested on suspicion of harming or endangering their fetuses, including by using drugs, attempting suicide, or, in a case in Utah, delaying a cesarean section. There's no reason to believe that in states where abortion is considered homicide, prosecutors will be less punitive when investigating it. Further, the abortion bans in the new wave are harsher than most of those that existed before Roe v. Wade," end quote. Sharon, can you weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think that there is a possibility that if there was a post-Roe v. Wade world with the kinds of statutes that have been enacted, you may very well see prosecutions of mothers. And my understanding, for example, is that the Texas statute that was at issue, one of the statutes that was at issue in Roe v. Wade, made it a crime to, quote, procure an abortion. And, you know, it's anybody who's going to weigh in on this really should read Roe v. Wade in its entirety, because the court went through the history of prohibiting abortions or not prohibiting abortions, because there are some theories that this was a very common thing in old Greek and Roman times, not necessarily prohibited by the common law, things of the sort. So, you know, you need to take a look at the history, but by the time 1973 that Roe versus Wade came around, there were very restrictive laws and very scary laws. One of the potential plaintiffs in Roe v. Wade was a doctor who had been prosecuted twice and was concerned about being prosecuted again. One of the arguments that was discussed in Roe v. Wade was the fact that there was a substantial disparity between people who could get safe abortions and people who couldn't, because people could still get illegal abortions, but they weren't safe. So the issues are much larger. In one of the cases that was about to hit the United States Supreme Court recently, and it hasn't yet, there was an issue about having abortions for reasons related to sex, race, or disability. You know, you read science fiction stories about people who might be having abortions because of the disability of their children, or and that quite possibly occurs. But is it something that we should legislate? So the issues, I think, are much, much deeper, and the constitutional protections are much, much deeper, and the issue of state rights versus federal constitutional rights is much deeper than simply the question of whether abortion is right or wrong.
Well, let me get some feedback from listeners on this. I'm going to start in Brighton with Barbara. First up, go ahead, Barbara.
Hi. Hi there. A whole bunch of thoughts. One, I've never understood why people who claim they're compassionate, which they are not, because it's all about force and shame, do not understand that there will never be no abortions or terminations. There will only be lack of safe abortions and terminations. And that is as far from compassionate for women, which are more than half the population, that you can get, okay? Also, they never really offer choice, because everybody, as the Reverend said, we're all pro-choice. I mean, we're all anti-abortion. There's just an issue of, do you have the choice or not? And that's what everybody loses in the argument. Everybody's focused on, oh my God, let's stop the birth, instead of let's let the woman make her own decision, which is how it has to be, whether they like it or not. And women's issues have always been political. Just ask Susan B. Anthony. And it's the same for African-American issues. They've always been political in this country. And as Sharon said, things have already gone downhill where women are being criminalized for enacting their own lives, which makes me insane. And, you know, so I don't really have a question, but I just want to say I'm really tired. I mean, I'm 74 years old. I've been arguing this for, I don't know, 60 years, 50 years. And just get out of my face is the bottom line. Leave us alone. I have absolutely no problem whatsoever with folks promoting no abortion. That's absolutely fine. I would defend to the death their right to do so. But don't step one inch over the edge into telling me or anybody else what to do. And I'll leave it there.
All right, Barbara, thank you. Reverend, I think a lot maybe moved in your direction there, so go ahead.
Okay. Well, thanks, Barbara, for the call. And I do strive as a pastor to be compassionate in all situations, and so I hope that you would see that even though there's your feeling is the compassion's not there, that we strive as Christians to live that way. I want to say that there's fear on both sides. You know, Sharon talked about the fears that people have of mothers being criminalized, and you know, what could happen in the future. But, you know, with New York State's law being passed last year, the fear on the other side is that, you know, now that we've essentially said that you're not a person until you're born, you know, what prevents that age from changing? And so, you know, there's fear on both sides.
Explain that concern. What do you mean? What would prevent that age from changing? What does that mean?
So, for example, there was a case, and Sharon probably knows this case better than I do, but there was a case that was pending last year when the law was changed. The person had killed a woman who was pregnant and was being charged with two counts of murder. After the law in January 2019, they were charged with one count. And so essentially saying that they didn't take the life of two people, but one. So New York essentially was saying that you're not a person until after you're born. So we, you know, the pro-life folks were concerned by comments by the Virginia governor when he was saying that, you know, sometimes the baby might be born and then a decision is made on whether to keep the baby or not. And so, you know, once you get on this slippery slope, when does it stop? You know, do we go down the path of some countries that say you're not really a person until you're two or three? Or do we go down the path of some countries that say if you have some disabilities, even though you're born and living and alive, you know, you're not contributing to society? So that's the fear on the other side. And I just want to make sure that that got mentioned, as well as the fears on your side.
All right. So let's let Sarah Clark, who could be headed for the New York State Assembly, address that. Go ahead, Sarah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the great things about the Reproductive Health Act that did happen was it took the doctors performing procedures and working with women out of the criminal code and put it into the public health, which is where it should be. These are truly health care decisions for women, and it should be treated that way on both the mother's side and the doctor's side. So we in New York are moving in the right direction and doing the right things to safeguard women's right to choose in our state. So I look forward to continuing that leadership and making sure that we stay on that same path. You know, there's a couple different things here. I think there was a lot of fear about this, like we've mentioned before, as you go further into pregnancies. These are decisions made for the care, the life and death situations, mostly for the mothers. I just think when we get into the fear argument over some of these quotes and stories that are told, we're talking about a very, very tiny percentage, and we're talking about really dire medical situations. So I really think we need to, the fear, I think, is misplaced, and it angers people, and it causes a lot of emotion, but it also then puts a lot of shame into the world of moms and doctors. And one of the other things that you brought up, too, that I think is it really needs to come clear is the equity issue. I mean, like Barbara said, abortion is never going to go away. And so the more you try to control and make this a legal or non-legal issue, the more you really disrupt equity. I mean, people who are of well means, of good insurance, can go places, they're always going to have access to clean, safe places. But then you're taking an equity issue out for women of lower income, a lot of women of color, and taking those decisions away from them because you're making it a legal issue instead of entrusting and empowering women.
Briefly, Reverend Ledoux, do you think that there should be criminal penalties for women who have abortions?
I don't know that I'm qualified to answer that.
But you don't think, obviously, no.
You know, in my ideal world, we're not arresting people for this. But in my ideal world, we're also giving every child a chance. So, you know, I know we don't live in utopia, but you know, my heart would break if we get to a place where we're arresting folks. I would hope we're, like I said, being compassionate, coming alongside folks and helping them deal with the situations they find themselves in.
All right. We're talking about a possible post-Roe America, what it means across the country, what it could mean for individual states that would have to make their own laws, and some have already codified laws. So we're getting the legal perspective from attorney Sharon Stiller, who is a partner and director of the employment law practice at Abrams, Fensterman, Fensterman, Eisman, Formato, Ferrero, Wolf, and Caron. Sarah Clark is a candidate for New York State Assembly in the 136th District, and Reverend Rick Ledoux is the lead pastor of United Methodist Church of Webster. We got more of your phone calls and comments after this, the only break of the hour. I'm Evan Dawson, Wednesday on The Next Connections. New York City has seen a spike in its coronavirus infection rate, 3% now. It was less than 2% just 24 hours ago. And the governor says it's got to get under control. The concern is, could it spread? Could it find its way to Rochester and the Finger Lakes? We're going to talk about what this means, what our numbers are, and the path forward on Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. Anna wants to know how many states would outlaw abortion if Roe is overturned. Best I can tell, and Sharon Stiller, I think it's around 20 that look like they're in position or ready to do that. It's hard to say exactly. I mean, we could see a lot of different legal frameworks in 50 different states, could we not?
Yeah, and I don't have a specific count either. But because it does vary from year to year, and then there are a bunch of states that has made the attempt, and there are district court injunctions, things of the sort. So it's a pretty volatile number.
Sarah Clark, another listener wants to know if we would actually see an inflow of migration to New York State. Do you think people would move across state lines, or do you think there would be less moving across state lines in a post-Roe America and more traveling to try to have abortions as women decide either to do that, or if they're, you know, maybe close enough to state lines where you can get from one state where the abortion is outlawed over into another? I mean, how do you see all of that playing out?
It definitely goes back to the equity point of now you're not just talking among race and income, but also about where you live in the country and what state you're in, which is why Roe v. Wade and the federal protections that it gave every woman in our country is so important to uphold. But I do see it. I mean, I do think people will come across for care. I think you see it now in some states where there's only one full provider of reproductive health care for women in certain states, and therefore people do travel already across state lines. So I definitely think you could see that happen in a post-Roe v. Wade world. You know, I also want to talk about, you know, we talked about that slippery slope or the fear tactics. I mean, the fear tactics on the side of restricting or making this legal or not legal are used a lot, yet haven't really come to fruition. Yet that slippery slope going backwards of restricting access for women, allowing companies to choose whether or not they cover birth control in their insurance plans. And we've seen the slippery slope backwards. So that fear is really real with women. I'm with Barbara. Like, I'm done having this discussion. I can't believe we're still fighting for women to just make their own decisions and have full access to health care.
Well, John in Fairport called to say contraception is not outlawed. The real question is, should it be funded through taxpayer dollars? He doesn't think it should, and he says, why should taxpayers be paying for women's sexual activity? Sarah Clark?
Well, this reminds me of a health insurance letter a friend of mine received many years ago when she was trying to get her birth control pills covered by her insurance plan. Her insurance plan covered Viagra, but not birth control. So there, I think when it comes to the choices women make, women are, this is seen as something that can be controlled, whereas men often are not held to the same standards. Women are, and their health decisions and their sexual activity decisions and all of that, people love to weigh in and give their opinions on it. Whether it's tax-funded birth control or not, we're also seeing insurance companies or businesses decide not to cover this. I just think that that's really old-fashioned. and not reality if we're really trying to talk about a world where, the family planning and women's choices are real. So I just think that it's silly to talk about not covering birth control. It is a person's health. That's what birth control is. And my friend who was denied, she was taking birth control pills for a physical health condition, which we haven't even touched upon. It's just
Evan,
crazy to think about.
I'm going to jump in for a second, if I can, that we forget the legal posture that things were in. So in 1965, there was a case called Griswold versus Connecticut, one of the landmark decisions leading up to Roe v. Wade. And in that case, the Connecticut law prohibited any person from using any drug, medicinal article, or instrument for the purpose of preventing conception. So there were laws that were outlawed starting in 1965 against using contraception, regardless of who paid for it, which is, again, one of the genesis, if that's the word, for the right to privacy recognized in Roe v. Wade. We can't forget our history.
All right. Reverend Ledoux, how do you see this question from the listener?
I think that you can leave that up to the different places. I don't want to force a Catholic organization that's standing on their doctrine to pay for contraception, but I think there's enough other places that would, that persons could find that covered. But I just want to jump in, Evan, if I could. Mm-hmm. The reason I accepted your invitation today is because this issue did become personal to me. My mother let me know before she passed that that in 1963, when she became pregnant out of wedlock, that she would have had an abortion if it was legal. And she let me know that because she was actually turning around to a positive and saying she was real proud of me and glad that that hadn't happened. So it's been always a real personal issue for me, knowing that I wouldn't even be here, and maybe some of your listeners would be happy with that. But, you know, for me, I'm glad to be around. And if it had been legal in 1963, I wouldn't be here. And over the years, I was pro-choice most of my life because I didn't give it much thought. But then when Mom shared that with me and I started to look at the science, I switched to a place going, you know, the science backs up life in the womb. And so I want to be completely pro-life as a pastor, supporting life from the womb all the way through a person and the end of their life. So that's why I said yes to coming on. I'm obviously not aware of all the legal ramifications that are involved with this issue. But again, I've been hoping throughout my pastoral career that we could have better conversations about this than we have. It seems like it does often get simplified. It does often get politicized, and we can't even sit down at the table and talk about it.
Is there a risk, Reverend, in taking that personal story, which is compelling? I mean, I understand the compelling nature of that, and thinking about existence versus non-existence, it sort of warps the mind. I've been there. Yeah. You know, and my own sort of spiritual journey, and I've gone in a lot of different directions because of those kinds of questions. But is there a risk to taking your own personal story and then deciding it ought to be good enough for policy for everybody?
Well, there's a risk in any of the decisions that we make. So that's, you know, I've always liked that phrase in the Constitution that says, you know, the preamble, in order to form a more perfect union, that we are trying to be better at who we are as a country and figuring it out and moving along. And so, we are working towards that. And so, you know, that's my hope.
Okay. Well, Sarah's time has got to be limited at 1:50, so I'm going to let you respond. Do you find I think the Reverend's story is compelling. I mean, I understand why it's a powerful personal story for him. Does that move you, Sarah?
I think there's powerful stories across the whole spectrum, which is why we go back to the point of choice and empowering women and doing what we can to make sure everyone has the choice to live their life based on the beliefs that they have, based on the family that they're in, their circumstances. Yes, of course, it's always meaningful to hear a story like that, But then it's also equally horrifying to think of women and children assaulted. And, you know, my physician once said to me, he is a very big proponent of pro-choice and allowing women to make decisions. And he has been a target of anti-choice folks for years. And he would say to me when we would get in discussions about it that he has done more to reduce the number of abortions and the women that he serves than any law has ever done, because he empowers his patients and his women and the women he serves to make their own choices and to understand and be educated about birth control methods and whatever else there is. So he always found it kind of ironic that, you know, they would come and protest him and yell in his face and do all this different arguings. And yet in a day-to-day practice, he was doing more to make sure that that was a circumstance faced less by the patients that he served, and that they were doing what they needed to, you know, they were being educated and making good family planning choices. And that was always really moving to me, because that's where we're trying to go, is to make sure women are educated, empowered, they have access to a good paying job and paycheck fairness. I mean, we haven't even gotten into all the different circumstances that lead women to certain decisions. And but at the end of the day, for me, it's really just about choice, and it's really just about not taking away that from women.
And briefly, Sarah, because you got a roll, if you're in the New York State Assembly, which you could be in November, is there more work that the Assembly has to do? Or are you comfortable with where the law is in this particular state?
I am comfortable. We made great strides codifying the protections for women and decriminalizing it, putting it in the Department of Health. We can do more. We can do a lot around equity. Again, there's that issue of who has access to health insurance. I mean, that's still private. Who, and that comes everywhere from the full gamut of reproductive rights for women. We can do more to... for me, it's really just obviously stopping any slippery slope and making sure that we're not walking back anything. We need to look at making sure women have access to clinics in their area for the whole gamut of reproductive rights, reproductive health care. So we still have some deserts up in the North Country and other places where there just isn't a lot of access. So we really need to continue on this same path, but I feel really, really proud to be in New York right now.
All right, Sarah, thanks for making the time for the program today.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Sarah Clark is a longtime legislative staff member for multiple members of the United States Senate and now a candidate for New York State Assembly in the 136th District. Let me get back to your phone calls. Nancy in Penfield is on next. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to make it clear that Mr. Ledoux does not represent the United Methodist Church's position on birth control, on family planning, and he needs to be clear about that, because he may be serving the United Methodist Church, but he is not representative of the United Methodist Church's position on those issues. I also want to state clearly that life does not end with birth. And as an adoptive mother, as a nurse, we need to talk about how are we going to feed these children? How are we going to provide them health care? How are we going to teach their mothers and fathers to be good parents for them? How are we going to make abortion a choice which is rare?
Okay. Nancy, thanks for the phone call. Reverend, can you just respond to her comments about the official position of the United Methodist Church?
Yes, I'm very happy to do that. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I did want to say that early on, that I do not speak for the church, my district, the conference. You asked me to come on, and so I'm speaking for myself. However,
yes,
the United Methodist Church does have a stance that is opposed to abortion in all instances except in the health of the mother and in cases of rape and incest. So it is a pretty pro-life statement as I read it. It does allow for those exceptions. But I do know that there are others who call themselves Methodists who read it as a more pro-choice statement. But to me, it's been, you know, because those exceptions make such a small percentage of abortions, I've always thought of it as a pro-life statement.
All right, a couple of listeners, Ingrid, there's a number. No, I'm sorry. Here, hold on. This is Magnus. Magnus writes to us on Twitter. Magnus just says, can your guest explain more about, I think he's talking about Rick. Magnus says, can your guest explain, I literally don't understand the fears that your guest is talking about. Not a person till 2 years old. Does that mean he worries that something like infanticide of babies is legal? There was some vagueness that I could not follow. That's from Magnus. Pastor?
No. Yeah, well, what we saw in Virginia was the governor had suggested that maybe we get to a place where when there's decisions to be made about whether the child lives or dies, that we actually have the child born and then the decision is made. So, you know, that was a conversation, and that's been discussed more in Virginia than elsewhere. But, you know, the question then becomes, how far do we go? Do we start saying that, you know, until somebody has become a productive member of society, do we start to say that somebody with some disabilities, you know, we discover at 2 years old that they're autistic, so we say, okay, well, that person is not going to help us, so we can get rid of them?
Well,
that's the fear on the other side. It's just where do we stop when we start deciding that life, we can take the life.
Yeah, so Sharon Stiller, just on the legal side of things there, the story that the pastor is talking about in Virginia, first of all, the governor's comments, I think, did energize a lot of concern. And at the same time, the governor has made it clear he is not in favor of killing babies who have been born. I don't know any... I literally don't know anybody who is. And I understand the pastor's concern, Sharon, if that were a sort of regular argument to be made that, hey, you should be able to kill after birth if you don't like the outcome. But I'm not being flip. I mean, I understand what Reverend Ledoux is saying, but I don't hear it, Sharon. Do you on the legal side? I don't know that that's an actual argument that people are...
No, I've read many of the cases, and I've never seen that as an argument, nor do I think it really is an argument. I don't know the circumstances under which the governor of Virginia made the statement, but I can tell you that that's not a that has nothing to do with Roe versus Wade. Roe versus Wade, excuse me, looked at those issues very carefully. And as I mentioned in the beginning, came up with really a compromise. It's not there are various situations in which it's appropriate for the state to regulate, and there are situations in which it's not. So that I don't think has anything to do with the viability of Roe versus Wade.
Okay, about a minute a piece here as we get ready to wrap. Reverend Ledoux, you know, you point out that New York State has codified abortion and is very unlikely, even in a post-Roe world, to end up in a position that maybe, for example, many southern states would. So I understand that, but how do you see your work changing, if at all, in a post-Roe world? About a minute. Go ahead.
I'm so glad I'm part of this group, Caring Choices Pregnancy Help Center. They are helping people who are in those situations that find themselves in a crisis pregnancy to come alongside them to make sure that they have the support they need. They also offer programs for men. They also offer programs for women who have had abortions to have support groups to talk through what they've experienced. I love the compassion of this organization, so that's why I'm there. In a post-Roe New York State, I want to continue to work with them as they reach out and come alongside women and support women's health.
And Sharon Stiller, how fast do you think we're going to see, if we do see a post-Roe world, and I take your point earlier, that's not at all a done deal, but how fast could states move? I mean, I guess it's as fast as legislatures want to address it.
Yeah, I think states can move as fast as they want to move, and maybe states will be moving right now to just make sure that there are choices if anything was to happen to Roe v. Wade. But I think it's so important
for people to feel free to speak on this issue, and I think it's so important for people to really understand the legal basis mm-hmm. for the cases and for the rights.
Well, that's why I knew I called the right person. Sharon, thank you,
as always.
Thanks for making the time.
Thank you.
Sharon Stiller is a partner and director of the employment law practice at Abrams, Fensterman, Fensterman, Eisman, Formato, Ferreira, Wolf, and Carone. The only time I bungled it on the last time through. She's a board member for the National Women's Hall of Fame. Heard from Sarah Clark earlier this hour, and Reverend Rick Ledoux is the lead pastor of United Methodist Church of Webster. And the goal is, as always, is to understand one another better. And Reverend Ledoux, thank you for making the time to come on. And I hope we can continue these discussions. I know you do it in your work, and thanks for coming on with us.
Yeah, thanks for the chance, and I enjoy having the conversation. Thanks,
you got it. Reverend Rick Ledoux. Listeners, a lot of feedback, and I know didn't have time to get through all of it. But I suspect this is hardly the first of these kind of conversations, given the current landscape on the legal side of things in this country. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.